The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly, this week on the show.
Why not design our technologies so that they actually improve our sense of happiness or connection with each other or self-awareness? I think that's a really important ambition.
Rohan Guntulaki is on a mission to fix our growing dysfunctional relationship with technology with some cleverly designed tech. I'll be discussing the logic behind his mindfulness app, Buddhify 2, and it's a bonanza of appy news this week. Joining me will be Alex Hearn and Samuel Gibbs. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
We will be talking about the European Commission, who published a big report on the app industry in the UK. There's a boom on. Also, the UK's leading app developers lend some tech savvy to assisting those affected by the UK storms with a flood hack day. And we look ahead to the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona next week, where Mark Zuckerberg will no doubt be promoting Facebook's app success. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. In the last week, the office of Neelie Kroes, the EU Commissioner for the Digital Agenda and the EC Vice President, released its assessment and roadmap for the app economy in Europe, called Sizing the EU App Economy. The report makes some bold statements about this area of technology. Some, including the reporter who covered this story for The Guardian, that would be Stuart Dredge, who joins us down the line. Stuart suggests it might even be fueling the app hype gold rush. Speaking for Neelie Kroes, Ryan Heath from the EU Commission had this to say about Europe's ranking when it comes to app development.
5 years ago, the app economy did not exist. You didn't have apps on your smartphone. None of us in this room owned a tablet. But today in Europe, there are 1 million app developers. They support an economy that consists of 1.8 million jobs. Almost all of them are middle-class jobs, and they bring in revenues of 17 billion euros every year. And that's important. This is not fluff. I think sometimes, because this sort of business is below our own personal radar, we think that it's just about games or it's just something for teenagers. But it's very, very real in economic terms. But not only in economic terms. It's also things like cultural content. It's the new way that we can bring Europe's rich cultural heritage to the world. It's about things like citizen rights. It's even for institutions like the EU. Look at our passenger rights app, for example. And what's most important, I feel, is that we're used to being defeatist or second rank when it comes to technology in Europe. And that's not true here. We are level pegging. We are level with the US when it comes to app development. And we are also the biggest in many respects. Look at a game and a series of content like Angry Birds by Rovio in Finland. They got an audience of 50 million in 35 days. That's the fastest ramp up of any technology in history. And it happened here in Europe. And what this study shows is that by 2018, if we do the right things, there could be 4.8 million jobs, an extra 3 million jobs in the next 5 years. So Neelie Kroes has got two messages that come out of this news. The first is, in particular if you're a young person, wake up to this opportunity, get ready, go out and grab one of these 3 million jobs for yourself. And then her second message is about our core job as European regulators. And it's about making sure we don't throw this excellent, fast-moving train off course. And there's three things we need to do to make sure that happens. First is make sure we give these app developers connectivity. That's why we want to make it faster and easier to invest in broadband. Two is we need to give them net neutrality. Net neutrality does not exist in law for 97% of people in Europe today. We have to give them that protection. We have to give it to them in a form that doesn't kill innovation, that doesn't stop these app developers from doing what they do best. And that's why we need members of the European Parliament to vote in favour of net neutrality laws in the coming weeks. And we also need to end roaming. When you have hundreds of millions of people turning off their data or turning off their phones and their tablets completely when they roam, what they're doing is turning off the lifeblood of apps.
So, a good day in the app sector in Europe. As I mentioned, joining us down the line is Stuart Dredge, author of The Guardian's Apps blog. Stuart, what are the top line statements in this report?
Well, the top line stuff is they're trying to size the market in the EU, which no one's really done before. So they think that last year, app developers in Europe earned about 17.5 billion euros. And interestingly, they think that 6 billion of that came from kind of consumer apps, so games, music apps, the stuff we kind of see on the stores. But then nearly double that, 11.5 billion, came from contract labor, so projects for other companies or internal projects for things like banks and retailers. And they reckon it's a million app jobs across the EU last year, and then this will rise to about sort of just under 3 million by 2018. So kind of what they were trying to say is everyone learn app skills, go and get a job in the apps market. It was kind of a very bullish report on that score.
It certainly was. In fact, I noticed that in your report, in your coverage of this report, you said that Neelie Kroes had said that, you know, we don't need to be worried about youth unemployment anymore because everybody can just go skill up and become an app developer. But you yourself voiced some skepticism about this by calling it a gold rush. And I would propose even an app bubble. Really, how buoyant is the apps economy, Stuart?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, it's one of those places where it's very top heavy. So the top few consumer apps are making loads and loads of money. And then a lot of people are losing money. And there are a lot of hobbyists who aren't trying to make money, just releasing stuff. And the nature of the stores means you can release an app and not have to spend too much on it. So in one sense, I went into the report with quite a lot of cynicism, thinking it's going to be saying everything is marvelous and get a job. And that's worrying. But actually, I quite like the fact that it did say the money is to be made in the less obviously sexy parts. And while you can kind of go and say, I'm going to make the next Snapchat or the next Angry Birds, actually maybe looking for banks and sort of financial houses and retailers and so on, that might be the kind of more sustainable business. So in a way, it was deflating a bit of that hype, and it was saying, look beyond the surface and look where the real money's been made.
And this 11.5 billion euros of contract labor, I mean, this is an interesting figure because it's work for hire. It's a work for hire contingent of the software industry in the EU. I certainly know that the computer games industry has been suggesting that they would move into such a so-called studio system for a while, wherein certain people who are particularly adept or have a particular price point and certain skills will be brought in for certain projects. Is this something that is already established in the apps market?
I think so. I mean, there's a lot of companies doing both. There's a lot of developers who've got their own ideas for consumer apps, but they fund their companies by doing work for hire, whether it's other consumer apps or stuff for brands. I mean, there's a load of branded apps out there that phenomenal amounts of money being made by developers for them, even if no one downloads them. So there's a lot of work out there, and a lot of developers, I think, they have their idea, they have their dream of the one app that's going to make them an amazingly popular startup, but they fund the development of that by doing kind of less interesting, well, not less, this is less obviously exciting work for hire. And the other reason it's undercovered, really, is that these people often can't talk about it. I mean, big banks don't talk about the apps they're using internally because it's kind of part of their business and they want everyone else to know. So it's very hard to kind of to write about that market, and that's why a lot of us journalists seem to end up concentrating on the photo sharing apps or the games. But it's out there, and it's bigger than a lot of people thought.
And it certainly does seem as if in this report that the gaming sector and one or two companies really skew these stats. How do consumer apps in general fare in comparison?
I think, well, the vast majority of consumer apps, no one ever downloads them, no one ever spends money on them, and they kind of disappear without trace, or they just languish there in the app stores. So it's a very squiff market. So obviously we look a lot at the big successes and like the big games companies that are making, you know, up to sort of $1 billion in a year from games. But yeah, in terms of consumer apps, it's hard. I mean, I talk to a lot of children's app publishers, and they find it very hard to make money on the app stores because parents don't want to spend money on apps for kids, which sounds strange. Music apps, again, there's some successes, but a lot more failures. So yeah, it's a very tough market. It's very easy to launch an app, and it's very hard to make it a success or even to let anyone know about it.
Samuel, you've responded by saying that the report claims that less than 0.1% of consumer apps are considered a financial success, and this is obviously backed up by what Stuart has been saying here. Why are there so many small companies or hobbyists or individuals betting the farm on this market then?
I put it down to the fact that people don't realise this. People think that it is a gold mine. It's easy, as Stuart said, it's quite easy to actually get into it. To make a success is very, very difficult, and people don't appreciate quite how difficult it is. I mean, for people looking on the outside, without any real knowledge of how the app stores work and etc., it looks relatively easy to get onto and make money. You hear all these success stories about people making a lot of money. I mean, for instance, look at the Flappy Birds thing from last month or so. He was making in the region of $50,000 a day in advertising revenue, which is crazy money, really. But how he got up into the echelons of being in that many downloads, it is a mystery to us. There were accusations of gaming the system. We don't know whether that was true or not. But, you know, it's very difficult for these one-man band, these small developers, to get anywhere near that kind of exposure.
So, Stuart, looking at the report, as we're talking about some of these conglomerates, we're not just talking about homebrew French folks or homebrew Brits or you know, anybody sitting in their bedrooms. How many of these top flight games companies or these games conglomerates are EU originated rather than just EU based? And is this potentially buoying the figures in the report?
I think it does. I mean, I think you're seeing different parts of Europe having different approaches. So, for example, Finland is very exciting at the moment, partly because Nokia has had a dreadful few years, but also as part of that, they had quite a good scheme for people who wanted to start their own startups coming out of Nokia. So there's a lot of developers coming out of there setting up their own games companies, and you have companies like Supercell, which I think they made about nearly $1 billion from two games last year. But behind them is a lot of little Finnish startups coming along saying, we can be the next Supercell. So you've got little micro ecosystems where there's one successful developer doing really well and then a lot of others starting up in their wake. And you've got people like King, which has been around for a long time in Europe. And it started off making kind of gambling skill games online, then went into Facebook. And now Candy Crush Saga has been such a huge success. It's IPOing in the US. So you are getting European companies starting over here, but quickly scaling up globally. So if you're a Supercell, you can be in Finland, but have a huge game in Japan. If you're King, Candy Crush Saga can be big in every country in the world, which compared to the traditional console industry, where you did have more of that, which region are you in? How do you distribute your games? How do you get through a publisher? That's one of the things that has removed the barriers for European firms to really get big really quickly.
So Alex Hearn, is this about trying to build a sustainable app economy?
I think partially, and I think certainly the carrot of a sustainable app economy is being used to encourage a few reforms that people within the EU would quite like to see. So, for instance, Neelie Kroes' office is using this to push for reliable, pervasive and fast broadband, to push for new IT job skills to be taught in schools throughout the European Union. But I'm inclined to think that there's actually a strong political aspect beyond the economy. The EU has been fighting, you know, battles around internet regulation, around privacy, around security for a few years now. And it knows the difficulty of negotiating with the United States, which has the headquarters of Apple, of Google, of Facebook, of Amazon, of Microsoft, of essentially every enormous internet company. And I think there is a qualitative difference between giants like that and most of the large but still, you know, normally sized companies that are based in the EU. 100 Spotify's is not the same as one Apple, because 100 Spotify's will never coalesce together to fight for the same side. They'll never be able to actually pull political sway. They're just 100 companies, and these big multinational companies that the EU really wants of its own are a different beast entirely.
Well, you can read more of Stuart's coverage on this report at theguardian.com/technology. And you can read more on Stuart's coverage of the apps business market at theguardian.com/technology/appsblog. Now, app makers aren't just in it for the money, clearly. No, some are fueled by a passion to help the world. And this week, leading developers gathered in Google's London campus for a Flood Hack Day. Alex, you wrote about Flood Hack. Tell us a bit more.
Well, essentially what it was is on Friday night, with admirable speed, the Cabinet Office and Tech City UK decided that they would call some of the leading lights of the UK tech scene together to see what they could do in 8 hours in Google's campus building with 3 months of Environment Agency data on flooding, and basically just contribute their skills to try and work out ways to help people. There were 200 developers there overall, and throughout the day they worked on 18 different apps. Of those 18, 8 were shortlisted by a judging team from the Cabinet Office, and they're a really massive range of things. The most impressive probably coming out of the day was one made by a team from Uswitch, the price comparison network. A very simple app. The idea is in the name. Who do I contact in case of a power cut? It lets people put in their postcode and find out who the immediate port of call is if their power's gone out. That's not actually a service which anyone had really decided to offer. Obviously, power delivery in the UK is fairly fragmented. The people delivering the power to your door aren't the same people you pay your bills to. So it's a helpful little service which was made in just 8 hours and is actually live now. Beyond that, there's an interesting idea, citizen flood journalism, which actually basically automates the system of finding people who are in flood-affected areas, asking them to take photos and share details, and then coalescing it all in one central database. That's not fully up and running yet, but even the beta version that was put out in the day shows some interesting ideas.
One interesting element of this story, though, is that the Environment Agency, who've been rather closed about the data that they gave that they give out, opened up 3 months' worth of data for this event.
Yeah, so the Environment Agency traditionally and historically has kept its data under lock and key, essentially. For this event, they gave the developers 3 months of data under an open government license, which is essentially the UK government's way of making something not quite in the public domain, but pretty publicly accessible. After May 2014, it's going back down, it's going back in the vaults, and the Environment Agency will carry on licensing it to people who are prepared to pay money.
Is that why they're so cagey about their data, Alex? Because they want cash?
Well, so income from commercial information licensing is estimated to be around £4 million a year for the Environment Agency. So that's not something to be sniffed at. And, you know, this is money which would have to come from the taxpayer if it didn't come from commercial organisations which need the Environment Agency's money. At the same time, you look at something like the floods and you realise that they have cost quite a lot more than £4 million. And maybe if people had had better access to flooding data, we might have been able to ameliorate these problems. The hope amongst open data campaigners is that these floods, this hack day, and the political will behind it will lead to a revolution in whether or not the Environment Agency is allowed to keep its stuff hidden away.
So who was involved with this hack day? You mentioned Cabinet Office and Tech City UK. How did it actually come about?
Tech City UK went to Number 10 and said, let's do this, essentially. A team from Conversocial, Silicon Roundabout management company, pulled the event together. In 2 days, they got 200 developers from companies like Google, Facebook and Twitter. Some of the developers stayed within their own little remit. So there was a company who are involved in allowing people to find locally sourced food, whose idea was unsurprisingly based around food. But other ones decided to spread out a bit. So Floodbud, which is a web service that lets people find out who to call when they have a power cut, was put together by a team from Judil, which is an online business data firm. So people were branching out.
One of the criticisms of hack days is that the people organising them, and The Guardian has organised its fair share of fantastic hack days, but they get free labour or they get free ideas from people. So is this what the Cabinet Office got out of this? Was it good feeling and free ideas?
I think there was good feeling and there was free ideas. At the same time, this is one where it is unambiguously for a good cause. You can argue that the Cabinet Office should perhaps have done some of these hacks themselves before the floodings happened. You can argue that the Cabinet Office should be paying these developers for their time. But at the same time, given the number of people in affected areas who are volunteering their time free, I think you'd be hard-pushed to find any of those 200 developers who begrudged the 8 hours of labour.
I shall put my cynicism aside then. You can read more on Flood Hack at theguardian.com/technology. Mark Zuckerberg is due to speak at next week's Mobile World Congress in Barcelona. The company has struggled to really exploit their mobile platform offering, but they've recently rolled out paper for the iPhone and have had some success with their Android Home. Now, Samuel Gibbs is going to be covering Mobile World Congress for The Guardian next week. Samuel, do you think that the CEO of the company, Mr. Zuckerberg, will mention the words Facebook, paper and home in his speech?
Undoubtedly. Yep. This is the first time, as far as I'm aware, that Zuckerberg has given a keynote at something quite so mobile focused and really draws kind of a laser eye on how important mobile is to Facebook. as you said, they've launched a couple of apps, Paper being one of them, which really captured the imagination of the US press. It's not currently available in the UK, and we don't know when it will be. But in the US, people have been singing its praises, thinking this is actually really quite good. And Facebook's done quite a lot of work on its mobile apps. I mean, it's no wonder, because it currently has 945 million active monthly users on mobile. That came from December last year, out of its 1.23 billion monthly users. So, you know, people aren't often exclusively using Facebook on mobile, but those that use it on the desktop almost invariably do use it on mobile. So it's a big platform for them.
Why do you think, though, that they've been unable to capture the attentions of the mobile market? Because ultimately, I believe most people go to Facebook or have gone to Facebook historically on their phones via third-party apps.
Talking from an Android perspective, the Facebook app on Android historically used to be rubbish. They put most of their focus on the iPhone app, and understandably so, because at that point there were many, many more users. It wasn't until Mark Zuckerberg realized how rubbish it was and then forced his internal staff to actually use it did they suddenly kind of start to become parity. So now the Facebook app on Android is as good as iOS, and both are leaping and jumping forward. Each revision is better than the next. They've sped them up. They've made them much more efficient on the systems, and also made them more appealing. I mean, they still look like Facebook, and that's where, say, Paper really goes one step further. It doesn't look like Facebook on the desktop. It looks like a completely different experience, a mobile-first experience, perhaps. So perhaps that's what Facebook really needs to go with. You know, I mean, that's not to say that it's not had success on mobile. It definitely has. And you've only got to look at things like Instagram, which it bought, and it was a mobile-only solution up until recently when they launched a desktop kind of version. But everything is mobile-first for that. So they just need to work on the UI, I think. It's the experience that people have on mobile, and they're getting there.
We'll talk more about Mobile World Congress next week when we speak with you from the floor. But meanwhile, Facebook is also in the news this week because it's responded to user criticism by releasing an extraordinary range of gender options for people's profiles, a far cry from the binary 2 it offered previously. Now, Alex, surely giving us the option of 50 is just them having a laugh.
Well, I'd imagine if you poll Facebook's users, you'd actually find people describing their gender, if they could, in far more than 50 terms. Facebook has actually gone with a vaguely traditional set of alternative gender descriptions, essentially. They have ways of describing the two binary genders that we're all familiar with already. So rather than taking their preset male option, you can pick a custom gender and describe yourself as a cis male. They also have a lot of other ways of describing male, though. You can also call yourself a trans male, a trans star male, female to male, transgender male, transsexual male, and cisgender male. Even those still stick within the gender binary that we're all mostly comfortable with. There are essentially a lot of different ways of describing two different things: men who have always been men, and men who were assigned female at birth. Beyond that, they get into gender descriptions that people are less familiar with. You've got ones like neutra and intersex and agender, which are all ways of describing people who don't really lie at either end of the gender spectrum. And then you have concepts like two-spirit, which is a Native American conception, again, lying somewhere in between male and female. What's odd about the whole thing is that while Facebook appear to be trying to please everybody, they can't quite let go of control. They haven't just offered a text box that let people write in whatever gender they want. You have to pick from 50. And there's some interesting ones that are missed out. So Hijra, a South Asian third gender, which is actually legally recognized in Bangladesh, isn't there at all. If you're a Bangladeshi Hijra who's moved to Silicon Valley, you can't get your gender recognized by Facebook. I think if we look at it, a lot of it will come down eventually to advertising. if you give someone a text box, you have to deal with the potential of an infinite number of genders being entered, including the sort of joke ones that people do put down for religion and politics in Facebook already. And the ability to segment people by gender is pretty important for advertisers. If you've ever switched your gender on Facebook, you'll notice suddenly you go from lots and lots of pictures of naked women offering themselves up for sex in seconds to lovely wedding dresses and cakes.
Anyway, that's the state of the world that we live in. I mean, it is interesting the way that it might affect gender, not least of which because, as you say, people are still going to have to pick kind of either a sort of a male or assigned male or a female assigned female or all situation. They're not sort of branching out and letting people play around.
Right. And also, they're not branching out and letting people letting people refuse to specify a gender.
So who is behind this move? I know that this has been in response to years of lobbying from all kinds of different communities, from the trans community all the way through. But who's the person who's really been the spearhead of this project?
So there's a software engineer at Facebook called Brielle Harrison, who is herself transitioning. As she says, all too often transgender people like herself and other gender non-conforming people are given a binary option, whether they're male or female. And for a lot of people, that doesn't fully describe how they see themselves. Brielle actually is, as someone who is transitioning from male to female, is in a relatively easy situation given what Facebook used to have. Fundamentally, the option to switch from male to female has always been there in Facebook. People who don't see themselves as either male or female have actually reacted to this change with glee, essentially. You know, if you don't think that he or she describes you, and Facebook has previously forced you into that option, this can be quite important.
Well, for all of our Facebook news, go to theguardian.com/technology. If you're a tech journalist, I can pretty much guarantee that if you head to the pub, start a conversation at a train station, or even get into the back of a cab, you will invariably end up talking about what the internet is doing to us. More often than not, people will say, loads, and not without a wistfulness in their voice that belies something about what they think was the way things were. But the reality is, even if you wanted to stop using tech, it'd be really hard to eschew it altogether. We are so inexplicably interwoven into our devices, and of course they into us, that we're practically cyborg. So, rather than get rid of them altogether, why not put them in their place? Why not be more mindful of how we use them and develop a positive us-them relationship rather than knee-jerking about how much they are taking us away from the rest of the world? One of the people at the forefront of this approach is Rohan Guntalaki, developer and meditator. He's involved in something called Mind Positive Technology, and he has just released the second version of his meditation app, Buddhify 2. I spoke with Rohan, recently voted by Wired Magazine as one of the 50 people in tech who are about to change the world. I began by asking him what a mind positive product is.
Quite simply, it's something that uses technology that's at the same time actually good for our minds. I think because so much of our technologies are considered to be bad for our minds, be that they distract us or they ruin our attention spans, but that's mainly because they've not been designed for our well-being. And so what we're interested in is how do you actually create and design technologies which are deliberately intended to result in well-being.
But is this something that is, it's fulfilling a need that we don't necessarily have? Or do you truly believe that we need this kind of thing in our lives?
Well, just get some people in a room and ask them like what their relationship with their technology is like, be it just social media or what they use at work. And they'll just sort of groan or raise their eyebrows or let out a cry of anguish. And the thing is, like, these technologies are so central to all parts of our lives, and we can't afford to keep having such a negative reaction to them and relationship to them. And so why not design and redesign our technologies so that they actually improve our sense of happiness or connection with each other or self-awareness? I think that's a really important ambition.
It is quite an uphill task, I imagine, however, because many people who are developing services are more driven by the bottom line than than by inspiring things, as you say, like happiness and connection. What is the community like who are building such mind positive products, and are they making headway into the greater app market?
Yeah, I'm really excited about sort of being part of a group of people and companies engaging in this space. I think we've seen in the last 2 to 3 years a massive boom in using technology for positive physical outcomes, such as all the wearables, the Fitbits, the fuel bands, and all that movement. And I think the natural place to go next is from physical health to mental health. And I think we're starting to see more and more types of product and app come out there. I think this year we'll see 2 or 3 really interesting hardware technologies that relate to our sort of show our brain waves and sort of do mind training that way. And in the sort of area that we've started in, this whole area of meditation and mindfulness apps, in the 2 years since we put out our sort of very first experimental product, we've seen quite a lot of growth in the space. Like 2 years ago when we put out the first Buddhify app, the idea of using an app at all for meditation was seen as a sort of unusual thing. But since in those 2 years, it's become more and more common. And so that's the trends are positive, in my opinion.
What is your methodology? How do you go about deciding what should be included in a mindfulness app? And what kind of training do you have that you feel particularly puts you in a position where you are capable and credible as somebody who creates such mind positive services?
I think so. The first question of how we come up with particular things, it's very much around user research. And so particularly in my case, the growth of mindfulness meditation in sort of general pop culture has been quite significant in the last few years due to quite a lot of scientific sort of studies and into the benefits and effects of this kind of training. And as someone quite active in and interested in experience in meditation, I was having a lot of people come to me and asking about what I could recommend and whether any particular products or services or apps. And it was through just dozens and dozens and maybe hundreds of conversations with all sorts of people, but mainly people sort of my age, sort of out of my sort of type of person. So someone quite tech savvy, living in a city, mid-20s, early 30s, and just sort of understanding, taking the sort of so-called sort of user-centered approach and just talking through them, what are the issues of why weren't they getting involved? Because in meditation stuff that already existed. So there were classes and courses and books and CDs and all this sort of thing available, but what was stopping them take that next step? And so it was through those conversations and through the insights that I gathered through that process that led into the design of the apps we've made. And as to my own experience, I first got interested in meditation 10 years ago, and so I've got 10 years' experience in practicing and studying meditation sort of all around the world. And I've done the sort of traditional thing of going out to Asia, and I spent months in the Burmese jungle and the Thai jungle. So I've done all that. But at the same time, I've also spent 10 years working in technology, be that as a technology consultant for a big consultancy or as a innovation funder, and as a sort of producer and sort of policy advisor as well. So I've worked in technology in all kind of ways. And so the sort of products we're starting to make are very much the combination of these two aspects of my life, I guess.
So the new iOS app that you released at the beginning of the year, it's called Buddhify 2. Talk me through it. What is it?
Sure. Well, the core idea at the center of Buddhify is that you can learn mindfulness and meditation wherever you are. So whether you're sort of traveling around or at the gym or at work, even if you're online, that's an opportunity to learn mindfulness and meditation. And that sort of is surprising to a lot of people because they think that you need to be in a special, quiet, calm place to learn stuff like this. But all you really need is a technique and the interest to do it. And that, again, this sort of comes from my very direct personal experience of how, because I was working in very busy sort of urban, digital, high-powered working life at the same time as pursuing my interest in meditation, I personally had to work out how do I develop mindfulness in these environments.
Well, you can purchase Budify 2 from the App Store now. And Rohan Guntalaki from 21 Awake, thank you very much for joining us on Tech Weekly.
No, sure. Thanks, Alex.
That is it for this week. Many thanks to our studio guests, Alex Hearn and Samuel Gibbs, and to Stuart Dredge down the line. We are back next week, so tune in on Wednesday, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from Samuel Gibbs at the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona. Until then, and hopefully after then too, Tech Weekly was produced by Jason Phipps and presented by me, Alex Kratosky. Have a good one.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.